Starting something new isn't just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When I started this podcast, I wasn't even sure what I was doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys my products? I definitely made a fool of myself. Now I know that I was right in believing in myself and launching the podcast, despite all of the fears and the hesitations. It also helps when you have a partner like Shopify on your side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if I get stuck? Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And their app is just objectively super dope. It's easy to use, well-designed, and helps me keep tabs on the American Hauntings clothing store while I'm on the go, or if I'm just too lazy to stare at the big screen for any longer that day. And you can trust me, my 9-to-5 job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might get confused or break technology. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. One more time, that's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
After keeping a low profile in the previous decade, the devil made a comeback in the 1940s. When soon-to-be war-weary audiences were both diverted and disturbed by satanic entertainment. Thanks to the darkness lurking in the world during those years, we shouldn't be surprised to find there were a number of genuinely ominous visions of evil captured on celluloid at the time. But who would have thought that one of the darkest and most fearsome appearances of the devil on film would be brought to us by Walt Disney? In the animated 1940 film Fantasia, Satan arrives for the final segment of the movie set to the orchestrated strains of Night on Bald Mountain, a faithful rendition of the composer's conception of the music, in which he had envisioned as a poem that evoked the forces of darkness on the demon-haunted Bald Mountain. The sequence incorporates a bit of German demonic lore into a Russian legend, since the devil awakens from the mountain on Walpurgisnacht, which is April 30th. The devil's spell conjures demons from hell and calls the dead to rise from their graves. The creatures of darkness then dance wildly until dawn, when the ringing of bells sends them back into the abyss. As the sun rises, very saccharine version of Ave Maria is sung by a candlelight procession of the faithful. Now let me stress once again, this is a Disney cartoon. It's the same film that includes a lighthearted sequence with Mickey Mouse as the sorcerer's apprentice. So I'm gonna bet that Night on Bald Mountain sent more than one kid home from the theater with nightmares in 1940. There is a cool side note to the story, though, if you're a classic horror fan. Disney animators tended to base their characters on human models, attempting to capture their personality in the artwork by streamlining certain aspects of their emotions and movements, right down to the essence. And who was the only possible model that Disney animators wanted to use for the devil? Well, they wanted Bela Lugosi, who'd created Dracula, as well as other enduring villains with commanding, larger-than-life gestures. Although his career was already fading by 1940, Lugosi rose to the occasion, lending his unmistakable charisma and authority to Fantasia's devil, with sweeping gestures that were immediately recognizable as his own. Lugosi's officially uncredited performance, made iconic by Disney animators, breathes life into what is Disney's darkest character. And it set the stage for the devilish on-screen portrayals to come. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror in every form, starting, of course, with our exploration of the devil and all his works. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And I want to thank you for joining me for episode 19, The Devil Goes to the Movies, part 2. Throughout the silent film era, one of the most adapted stories of the devil for the screen was obviously Faust. And in 1941, director William Dieterle transported the Faust legend to mid-19th century New England with the film The Devil and Daniel Webster. Adapted for the screen by Stephen Vincent Benet from his short story of the same name, he wrote a script that was a little more fantasy than horror, although Dieterle does manage to bring a haunting atmosphere to the film, likely because he'd had a large acting role in F.W. Murnau's 1926 version of Faust. Set in 1840 in New Hampshire, the main character is Jabez Stone, an impoverished but kind-hearted farmer who seems plagued by bad luck. After a series of mishaps, he impulsively declares he'd sell his soul to the devil if he could just pay off his debts. Well, as they say, speak of the devil and the devil appears. And soon old Nick is promising Stone 7 plentiful years in exchange for his soul. The deal is struck when the devil burns the date of their pact into a tree. Stone begins his new life with hope, paying off his debts and buying new tools and supplies, but as time passes, wealth begins to change him. After the devil summons a hailstorm to wipe out all the local crops, except for Stone's, of course, Stone ensnares his desperate neighbors with unfair financial contracts. He slowly alienates his devoted wife, Mary, and his pious mother. After Mary gives birth to their first child, he discovers the local girl they'd hired as a maid has vanished, replaced by the beautiful and sinister Belle, sent by the devil. She bewitches Stone, driving a wedge between him and Mary. And as their little boy grows up, he too falls under Belle's influence, and she turns him into a spoiled, disobedient brat. Belle bewitches Stone, who becomes even more obsessed with his money. While Mary stays behind on the family's humble farm, her husband lives it up with Belle in a luxurious mansion. Distraught, Mary contacts a family friend, the legendary senator, Daniel Webster, to whom she describes her plight. When Webster then visits Stone and tries to convince him about the dangers of living such a sinful life, Stone kicks the senator off his property. A few more years pass, and now Stone is one of the wealthiest men in the country. He throws a huge ball to celebrate his good fortune, but it ends in disaster. At the eerie party, a nightmarish dance occurs between Belle and an old man named Stevens, whose ruthless methods of debt repayment were what initially drove Stone to poverty and made him decide to take the devil up on his offer. When Stone finds Stevens dead on the floor, he learns the old man had also signed a pact with Satan, and his time was up. Now worried because he's realized that his own 7 years are nearly over, Stone tries to erase the deadline that Mr. Scratch, as they sometimes call the devil, burned into the tree outside the barn. But the devil returns and again tempts Stone, now offering to extend his deal in return for the soul of his son. Well, that's one step too far, and horrified, Stone flees and goes straight to Mary. He begs her forgiveness and pleads with Daniel Webster to help him find some way out of his bargain with the devil. Well, the former senator, now the most renowned lawyer in America, agrees to take the case. He believes he's clever enough that he can outsmart the devil. They confront Satan shortly before midnight, just minutes before Stone's soul will be claimed, and Webster declares that as an American citizen, Stone is entitled to a trial by jury. Satan agrees, but only if he can pick the jury. The jury is then chosen from the worst of America's villains, including traitor Benedict Arnold, the pirate Captain Kidd, and John Haythorne, one of the cruel judges of the Salem witch trials. The devil also sets down the ground rules. If Webster loses the case, then he too has to forfeit his soul. So Webster summons all of his rhetorical powers, making an emotional appeal to the jury's love of liberty as Americans, which was tarnished by their bargain with the devil. By declaring Satan's pact null and void, they can, at least in some small way, redeem their own lost freedom. Well, to the devil's aggravation, Stone is exonerated and the bargain is destroyed. Stone's mansion, a symbol of his ill-gotten infernal gain, explodes into flames and he reunites with Mary. Old Scratch, jaded by centuries of experience, takes the loss in stride, and the last shot of the film shows him glaring out at the audience, pointing his finger at all of us as he looks for a new soul to steal. It's an entertaining film, and character actor Walter Huston leaves a lingering impression as the devil, whose sinister persona is softened by wit and humor. This is a devil who enjoys his job, and a sinister smile almost never leaves his lips. His eyes glitter with both malice and amusement, taking delight in the suffering of those who dared to strike a bargain with him. It's no surprise that he received an Academy Awards nomination for Best Actor in 1941. The atmospheric score by Bernard Herrmann, who'd bring us the screeching violins of Psycho 2 decades later, became an important part of the film and earned him an Oscar as the composer. The supporting cast is just as good, with Edward Arnold as Daniel Webster, a man who truly seems to be able to give the devil a run for his money, and as Satan's beautiful assistant, Belle, the beautiful French actress Simone Simon has an otherworldly glamour that's all her own. She'd soon be on screens again as the unforgettable lead of The Cat People. Released only 2 months before the United States entered World War II, Webster's patriotic speech to the jury was well-timed to appeal to the national mood, pitting all American values against the temptations of Satan, who was, of course, quickly pressed into Uncle Sam's service as an unlikely comedic agent for the Allied cause in the 1942 film The Devil with Hitler. Trust me. No one's going to win any Oscars for this one. The Devil with Hitler was a quickie comedy short churned out by the Hal Roach Studios, who also did the Our Gang and Little Rascals shorts, to fill out the bottom half of double bills. And this movie, well, it's bad. In the film, Hell's board of directors votes to dismiss its longtime chairman, who is, of course, the devil, played here by Alan Mowbray. His record of evil has now been surpassed by the dastardly deeds of Adolf Hitler, who is elected to be his successor. Satan offers to visit Germany to demonstrate that even Hitler has some redeeming qualities, because any kind of goodwill on Der Führer's part would automatically make him ineligible to hold the throne in hell. Satan finagles his way into Hitler's inner circle, posing as his new astrologer, and then proceeds to do his damnedest to trick Hitler into doing some good deed, finally winning his place back in hell through trickery and impersonation. Finished off by an explosion on Earth, Hitler next appears in hell as a damned soul, prodded before the devil by his demon's pitchforks. Alan Mowbray was a debonair actor of the time and lends his usual flair to the role, although he's only required to provide a caricature of the devil for a film that only aims for the depth of a political cartoon. His rival, who plays Hitler, is Bobby Watson, who built a strange career for himself as a professional Hitler impersonator. I guess there was a market for that in the 1940s. Anyway, he'd repeat the role several times over the next few years. Watson is also the only actor to play Hitler in 2 satanic films. In the 1957 oddity, The Story of Mankind, he put on his Der Führer costume again, this time accompanied by a Satan played by Vincent Price. As a film, there isn't much to The Devil with Hitler. As an example of the ever-shifting persona of the devil in the American imagination, I suppose it has a place in that it reflects what was happening in the country's psyche at the time. In the 1940s, the concept of evil had shifted from the mythological Satan to the very real evil of Hitler. Well, the Devil with Hitler, produced in the backlots of Hollywood, could satirize the Nazi leader any way it wanted to. Director Marcel Carné, though, working in what remained of the severely censored film industry of German-occupied France, didn't have that kind of freedom. French directors were only allowed to deal with contemporary life in their films. That had to also praise the Axis war effort. So Carné decided to create a film that presented a vision of his demoralized nation, woven with the ageless quality of a fairy tale that evaded the restrictions of the time and place that had been put on the filmmakers by the Nazis. The 1942 film The Devil's Envoys takes place in 1845 and is about a traveling pair of troubadours who arrive at a large castle in some unknown region just in time for a grand party. They captivate the court with their songs of demons and marvels, leaving their audience literally spellbound. The two men are no ordinary traveling minstrels, though. They're servants of the devil, sent to cause mischief among mortals. Unfortunately, when they fall in love with two of their female victims, Satan is forced to step in before his amorous agents are entrenched in mortal love. Arriving at night on a black horse accompanied by the rumble of thunder, the devil pretends to be a wealthy noble and insinuates himself into the life of the castle. When the strutting, sinister Satan tries to lead a virtuous virgin astray and she resists him, the outraged devil transforms the girl and one of his own troubadours into stone. He's pleased with his magic until he hears the faint sound of the lovers' hearts still beating inside the stone. The hopeful message of the film was meant to be an allegorical comment on the situation faced by the French at the time. From a propaganda perspective, the castle is France itself, invaded by evil creatures meant to be the German occupying forces, led by the devil, who of course represented Hitler. The beating hearts encased in stone were understood to be the will of the resistance, waiting for the enemy's spell to be broken. Undoubtedly, French audiences of 1942 could be moved by such metaphors, considering their situation, but it makes it a little harder to appreciate the film today, despite how well acted and filmed it was. Other European films featuring the devil followed, including The Road to Heaven from Swedish director Alf Solberg in 1942 and 1943's The Hand of the Devil from Maurice Tournier, who used his camera like a paintbrush to compose a beautiful and atmospheric film. Based loosely on a short story by Gerard de Nerval, it tells the story of a failed painter who first appears as a haunted and anxious man rushing into a mountain hotel while carrying a mysterious box that he refuses to be separated from. He demands to know where the local cemetery is and is told that the hotel has been built over the top of it. When the box he's guarding disappears, he's plunged into despair and tells the other guests his incredible story. After his failure as an artist in Paris, he's offered a talisman said to provide its owner with fortune, fame, and love. The talisman, which is what was in that strange box, is a severed hand, which the painter purchased for a single coin. Immediately, the woman he desires falls in love with him, his paintings begin to sell quickly, and they are acclaimed as masterpieces. But of course, there's a catch. The devil then appears as a little man in black, and this pint-sized Satan claims the hand really belongs to him. And unless the painter can sell the hand for less than he paid for it, which was practically nothing, the devil will claim his soul. Well, with the market for dried-up severed hands not as strong as it could be, the painter fears he will be eternally damned until the devil offers him the possibility of buying back his soul for a price that doubles every day. Well, after 3 weeks, the price is astronomical, but the painter wins the money at a casino in Monte Carlo and then loses it. In desperation, he invokes the past owners of the cursed hand, and in one of the film's most effective sequences, he sees the history of the talisman when it was possessed by a king's musketeer, a juggler, an illusionist, a boxer, and finally the restaurant owner who sold it to him. He learns the magic hand was stolen by the devil from the tomb of a 15th century monk who was said to have miraculous powers. Well, now that he has this knowledge, he believes his pact with the devil is broken on the grounds that Satan can't sell what really belongs to the monk. But yeah, that's not the case. His soul can only be saved if he returns the hand to its rightful owner. So at the climactic moment of the film, he falls to his death and ends up buried with the box and the hand, luckily, in the monk's tomb. His soul is redeemed after all. Although the moralizing in the film is a bit heavy-handed, Turner is more interested in the macabre elements of the story, presented in a tight narrative structure. Later released in a subtitled English version as Carnival of Sinners, this mostly forgotten film is worth the watch if you can track it down. But it would also be Maurice Tournier's son, Jacques, who not only made a name for himself as a horror specialist in America, directing some of producer Val Lewton's best films for RKO Pictures, he also made the best satanic film of the decade when he did The Seventh Victim in 1943. The dark mystery called The Seventh Victim was inspired by a suggestion that Val Lewton made to screenwriter DeWitt Bodine about looking into seeing if he could get an invitation to a, quote, devil-worshipping society meeting. As a member of Lewton's tight horror film unit at RKO Studios, Bodine had already dealt with animal shipshifting in The Cat People and Haitian voodoo in I Walked with a Zombie. Although he wasn't sure what his eccentric producer had in mind for his next project, he dutifully set out in search of Satanists, making his first call to RKO's New York Research Department. As he later recalled, quote, "They had a marvelous office there in New York, and I went to them and I said, 'Is there any chance of me going to a devil worshippers meeting?' And they started laughing. But then they called me back and said yes, it had been rearranged. But I would have to go in under a pseudonym. The society would be glad to have me, but I wouldn't be able to say anything. I could just sit there and observe." In the 1940s, satanic groups were, by necessity, part of a secretive underground which was close to outsiders and wasn't interested in garnering publicity. Bodine later remembered that his hosts were exactly like the devil worshippers in Rosemary's Baby. He said, quote, "It was even in the same neighborhood on the west side they used in that film. It was during the war, and I would have hated to be Hitler with all the spells that were working against him. They were mostly old people, and they were casting these spells while they knitted and crocheted. A bunch of tea-drinking old ladies and gentlemen sitting there muttering imprecations against Hitler. I'd made use of that experience in The Devil Worshippers and The Seventh Victim, as they're ordinary people who had a basic flaw. An Achilles heel, which has turned them against good and towards evil." The story centers around a naive orphan named Mary, played by Kim Hunter, who leaves her religious boarding school to search for her sister Jacqueline, played by Jean Brooks, a darkly stylish young woman who owns a cosmetic company. When she arrives in New York, Mary meets Esther Reddy, played by Mary Newton, at her sister's company. Esther had been Jacqueline's assistant, and she tells Mary that Jacqueline sold the business to her 8 months earlier and has since disappeared. But a close friend of Jacqueline's tells Mary that she saw Jacqueline the week before at Dante's, an Italian restaurant in Greenwich Village. Mary soon discovers that Jacqueline has rented room number 7 above Dante's, but never actually moved in. Mary convinces the owners to let her see the room, and she finds it empty, except for a wooden chair and a noose hanging from the ceiling above it. Mary's investigation leads her to several individuals who knew Jacqueline, including her secret husband, attorney Gregory Ward, played by Hugh Beaumont, and a psychiatrist, Dr. Lewis Judd, who's played by Tom Conway. Mary learns that Jacqueline had been a patient of Judd's, seeking treatment for depression stemming from her membership in a satanic cult called the Pallidists and her failed efforts to leave the group. Jacqueline had been lured into joining the cult by Esther and some of her other co-workers. Mary next enlists help from private detective Irvin August, played by Lou Lubin, and he discovers that Jacqueline hadn't sold her company to Esther. She'd given it to her for free, which makes Mary even more suspicious. When she and the detective break into the company after hours, Irvin is stabbed to death by an unknown assailant. Mary flees into the subway where she witnesses two men board her car, carrying what seems to be a drunk man between them. When the sleeping man's hat falls off, though, Mary sees that it's actually the murdered detective. She attempts to alert the police, but the men vanish with the body before they can arrive. Well, shortly after this, Dr. Judd returns and offers to bring Mary to visit Jacqueline at his home where she's been hiding, and the doctor tells her she's on the brink of madness. When they arrive, Jacqueline is gone, and when Dr. Judd goes to search for her, Jacqueline briefly reappears and gestures for Mary to be quiet before disappearing once more. Determined to remain in New York until her sister is found, Mary takes a job as a teacher. And a short time later, Esther breaks into her apartment and confronts her in the shower. She urges Mary to return home, claiming that it was Jacqueline who murdered the detective Irvin August. Mary, fearing her sister has lost her mind, returns to see Dr. Judd, and together they resolve to find Jacqueline. And when they do, she recounts how she came to join the Pallidists, as well as how she inadvertently killed Irvin, believing him to be an assassin sent by the cult to kill her. The Pallidists, she explains, has a rule that any member who betrays the cult must die, and they believe that Jacqueline betrayed them by discussing the cult with Dr. Judd, who is, of course, an outsider. Jacqueline would be the seventh person condemned for betrayal since the founding of the cult. However, the cult doesn't believe in directly committing acts of violence except as a last resort. They goad the traitors into committing suicide instead. The cult kidnaps Jacqueline and, over several hours, try to convince her to take her own life. They harass her endlessly to drink a glass of poison that's placed in front of her, and when her nerves finally break, she reaches for the glass. But then one of her former co-workers knocks it out of her hand. Jacqueline leaves with an assassin following her, but she manages to elude him and return to her rented room above Dante's. On the stairway leading up to her secret apartment, Jacqueline briefly encounters her neighbor, Mimi, a terminally ill young woman. Mimi confesses to Jacqueline that she's afraid to die and plans to have one last night out on the town. Well, on her way out, Mimi hears the sound of a chair being kicked over in Jacqueline's room. That last camera shot holds for 4 or 5 seconds so that the fate of Jacqueline sinks in. She is the seventh victim, after all, escaping from the cult only to take her own life with the noose. It's a grim, nihilistic ending, but one that seems inevitable given the film's sinister quality and foreboding atmosphere. As editor Mark Robeson later said, quote, it had a tangible quality that was horribly real. I think the actors and the directors had to believe very strongly in the possibility of disaster, that something was there. We believed it ourselves. We talked ourselves into believing it. Much of the film's effectiveness is due to the enigmatic presence of Jean Brooks in the role of Jacqueline. In most of her other film roles, which were usually mediocre westerns and forgettable dramas, with the exception of another Val Lewton film called The Leper Man, she played a wholesome blonde. Considering the tight restrictions of Hollywood typecasting in the 1940s, this mysterious role was a real departure for her. With her pale, unsmiling face framed by a straight black wig, she has an exotic look that was never visible in her other films. Adding to Brooks's mystique is the fact that the actress herself vanished from Hollywood after her last film in 1946. Decades of speculation and rumors about her followed, but the mystery wasn't solved until an ad appeared in the Hollywood Reporter in 1990, asking if anyone knew what happened to Jean after her last film. Film historian Gregory Mank went searching for answers and was able to reveal the sad story. Like the depressed character of Jacqueline, Jean's own life was falling apart while she was making The Seventh Victim. She separated from her husband, actor Richard Brooks, during the filming, and they divorced the following year. It was also widely rumored at the time that she'd started drinking heavily. After the divorce, Jean stayed in Hollywood and tried to keep her career alive. Though she continued to land roles with RKO through 1944, her career began to unravel, and she was noticeably gaining weight as a result of her drinking. She arrived at a September 1945 film premiere, and a writer who was there described the scene, saying, quote, "Jean Brooks, sad to say, was smashed. She was very, very drunk. She must have been drinking all night on the train. Some of the people there were laughing at her. Others looked embarrassed. It was really very sad." Her film roles were soon reduced to bit parts, and her struggles with alcoholism and her disheveled public appearances resulted in friction with studio executives. Jean reportedly tore up her contract with RKO before they could fire her. Her final film, a war drama called The Bamboo Blonde, was released in 1946. After that, Jean left Hollywood. She later married a Marine Corps veteran named William Lansford, and they stayed together for the next decade, although her troubles with alcohol continued. They divorced in 1956, and Jean soon married a newspaper editor named Thomas Letty. They were still together when she died. In November 1963, Jean was admitted to a hospital in Richmond, California, suffering from cirrhosis of the liver. She died on November 25th. She was only 47 years old. She was buried at sea the following year, and while her death was reported in the papers in Costa Rica, there were no obituaries and apparently no knowledge about her death in Hollywood. The fate of Jean Brooks was no longer an unsolved mystery, but in this case, the truth turned out to be much sadder than the fiction that surrounded her disappearance for years. Now, there is another eerie connection to the actual devil with the making of The Seventh Victim. The name which DeWitt Bowden Dean gave to his fictional Satanists, the Pallidists, offers a clue about where he conjured up the film's basic plot. During his research, he apparently came across a devilish hoax that was perpetrated in Paris in the late 19th century. A social critic who wrote under the name Leo Taxil convinced most of France that an entirely imaginary satanic cult known as the Pallidists controlled the upper echelons of society. In a complicated conspiracy story, a woman named Diana Vaughn was said to be on the run from the Pallidists, who had vowed to kill her for betraying their secrets. The similarities to the film are pretty obvious, but there's more. He also discovered a German occult group from which he borrowed the idea of Jacqueline being harassed into drinking from a goblet of poison. The group, called the Freemasonic Order of the Golden Centurion, was said to annually elect one of its initiates as a willing sacrifice to the devil, requiring them to drink poison during a ceremony. Now, there's no hard evidence to say that this story is true, but fact or fiction, it was a plot element that added to the darkness of the film. And with that, we've reached the end of The Devil on Film in the 1940s. Reflecting on those terrible years of global bloodshed, the dawning of the nuclear age, and the years of exhaustion that followed the war, we find that many of the satanic films of the decade present a darkly pessimistic view that leaves no doubt that humanity really doesn't need the devil to encourage it to do evil. Thanks for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. And if you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows on the network and recommend them to your friends, your family, people you work with, and anyone you think would love them too. To say thanks for your support, we've got a discount code. That's just one word, podcast. and that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. That website is also home to our books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're really just a small business that's grateful for everything you do for us. We couldn't and wouldn't do all this without you, so thank you and good night, good luck, and I'll see you next time, as long as the devil doesn't get you first.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.